It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Wisconsin healthcare provider is rolling out a new harm reduction program to combat substance abuse in rural communities. Marshfield Clinic Health System is using federal funding to place naloxone boxes in 43 locations, ranging from Barron and Rusk counties in the northwest to Dodge and Portage counties in southeastern and central Wisconsin. The boxes contain the naloxone nasal spray known by the brand name Narcan that can quickly reverse an opioid overdose. The program involves community partnerships with more than 20 organizations trying to reduce overdose deaths in the state. Megan Barnett is the manager of Marshfield Clinic Health System's Center for Community Health Advancement. Megan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So what are these naloxone boxes? Can you describe them for us?
Yeah. So picture an AED box on the wall used to, you know, help with CPR when someone passes out. It's very similar to that. So these are clear boxes about the same size as an AED, and they contain Narcan, like you mentioned, along with breathing masks, gloves, and a tear-off instruction sheet on how to administer this life-saving medication for folks.
And there are instructions, I would imagine, then, about how to use naloxone?
Absolutely. So we have big signs around the boxes so you can't miss it, just showing people how to inject the nasal spray. They also have a version that is more a syringe. However, the more common medicine today is that nasal spray, because it's just easier to use, and people have higher self-efficacy with that nasal spray. So you'll find nasal spray in these boxes. And what's really neat about this medication is if someone's not experiencing an overdose and you think that they are and you inject this medicine into their nose, nothing bad happens. Like, I could inject myself right now, and there's no ill effects to it. So we like to tell people, don't be afraid of what might or might not be happening. Just do it, and it'll be okay. So that's something interesting about this medication that I think is beneficial for the communities.
How many doses might a box contain?
Yes, so two doses in a box, and there's at least two boxes in these boxes, in the naloxone box.
Okay, a box within a box. How do you decide where to place these boxes within communities?
Yeah, that is a great question. So we love to lean on our community partners to tell us where the best location is to put them. So we have been leaning on our partnerships, specifically with the health departments in these communities, to tell us where they should be placed. And then they work with those organizations to do that. So just to give you an idea of where some of these naloxone boxes are, a majority are actually in schools, which I found really interesting. And I think that comes from the Department of Public Instruction just having more eyes on whether or not these should be in schools. And there's been some strong stances on potentially even requiring schools to have access to naloxone, just in case of the unimaginable. So we have them in the schools, we have fire department, a few local agencies like libraries, and what else? Community Action Agency, Indian Head Community Action Agency. So really the community lets us know where it would be beneficial, and then we help support them in placing.
Megan, what would you tell parents, though, who might have concerns about having these naloxone boxes being around schools or in schools?
Yeah, great question. So I just like to say, you know, it's not bothering anybody, just like the AED or some schools have, you know, the EpiPens in boxes. This is just another measure to just make sure everybody is safe within that school. Everybody wants to be able to send their kid to school and hope that they're safe there. And sometimes accidents just happen. We heard a report from Crandon that a kid came to school with a water bottle And on the tip of the water bottle, there was fentanyl from home, from caregivers using, and that child accidentally overdosed, but was able to be saved because naloxone was available. And so you just never know what is going to happen. And so we just want to be prepared for that unimaginable event that hopefully we never have to encounter.
Who's responsible then for the inventory inside these boxes and restocking the naloxone?
Yeah, so that was definitely something that we worked through with each community to make sure that somebody is responsible. In the schools, it's typically the nurse, but the health department ensures that somebody is watching those boxes. We also have a lot of recovery coaches out in the community through another program that we have, and so we've been leaning on them to make sure that we have, you know, somebody keeping an eye on that inventory.
Because it's a number of boxes now. 43 is where you're at. Is that the number?
43. Yeah. Yep, 43 and continuing to disseminate.
We are talking about a new program placing naloxone boxes in rural Wisconsin communities. Naloxone, a medicine that rapidly reverses an opioid overdose. Megan Barnett is here, manager of Marshfield Clinic Health System's Center for Community Health Advancement. Megan, what are some of the challenges that come with harm reduction and treating opioid addiction in rural communities in particular?
Yeah, great question. So a few things come to mind. One being stigma is very real out in the communities, whether rural or urban. I think there's a lot of room for education on what this is and what it's not. There's a lot of stigma around enabling somebody. And then I would also say specifically in rural communities, the sources are so sparse, or the resources are so sparse and spread out. And so really trying to find where people are gathering, and frequently, you know, just hanging out so that we are getting these medications into the right hands. And then also just thinking about rural communities, think about how long it takes an ambulance to get to some of those very rural parts of the community. And so we want to make sure that people have Narcan with them in case of that emergency. And so we always tell people never to use alone, and also always assume that your supply is not clean, because 9 times out of 10, there are, don't quote me on that statistic, but oftentimes the supply of substances are laced with fentanyl these days.
And this is an ongoing opioid epidemic with, over 100 at least people dying a day from overdoses.
Yep.
Could naloxone be more effective if it were available in more places around Wisconsin?
I believe so. I think we need to reach this saturation level where it's just available 24/7, 7 days a week. And I think that will help us get ahead of the epidemic a little bit. There's so many other strategies too that we want to be focusing on. This is just one. But if we can reach that saturation level, that at least hopefully will help, you know, reduce those fatal events of overdose that we're seeing, 108,000 in 2022, which is 108,000, way too many. So,
and this program is relying on federal funds to get off the ground. How long is the funding there for to keep these boxes going?
Yeah, great question. So we landed this funding back in fall, and it was a short grant from the HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration. And so we actually just wrapped up the project in August. So these boxes have all already been placed. However, we are continuing with these efforts, and we're calling these kind of like the pilot communities, these 43 boxes and the 19 organizations. We're taking what we learn and we're packaging it. So Marshfield Clinic has a funding opportunity out for communities in our service area right now for communities to apply to get a box. And that is just straight funding that Marshfield Clinic is investing in their communities. And we also launched a Harm Reduction Saves Lives Toolkit, which is a campaign that any community can take and launch in their community. And the goal of that toolkit is really to get the conversation started about harm reduction, start reducing some of that stigma in the community. And there's even a PowerPoint in that toolkit that helps communities unpack how to implement a naloxone box in their community and who they should be talking to make that happen.
So it sounds like if a community or an organization wants to join into this partnership, wants to get involved in installing a naloxone box in their area, that there is an opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. Yep. Please just get in contact with us, with me, and I'd be happy to help anybody who might feel stuck or just doesn't know where to start, because it really starts with the conversation and making sure that community members are just on the same page about what harm reduction is. There's so many just misconceptions out there about it. And then I think, like, oftentimes there might be pushback at the beginning of, oh, I don't know if this is good for our community. And what we've seen with these 43 lax boxes is quite the opposite. And more times than not, people don't even know that they're there. Many of the times it's just there for emergencies, and hopefully we'll never have to use it.
Very quickly, are there other states with a track record of using these boxes that might be serving as a model?
That's a good question. I am not 100% sure. So I know that vending machines are very popular, both in our state and many others, right? And so this is just another kind of, this is, in my opinion, a mini vending machine for just to get, you know, out into other organizations that might not have the means to support those vending machines.
Sure, sure. Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Megan Barnett, manager of Marshfield Clinic Health System's Center for Community Health Advancement, with us to talk about a new substance abuse harm reduction program, placing 43 naloxone boxes in 4 Wisconsin counties. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the FTC wants to ban non-compete clauses for workers. A Texas judge blocked that ban. What's at stake for employees in Wisconsin?
Because they feel they may not be able to have a similar job somewhere else in the area as a way of bettering themselves, they feel stuck.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An estimated 30 million American workers are under a non-compete clause, according to the Federal Trade Commission, and that means there are limits on the kinds of jobs they can seek if they leave their current employer. Earlier this year, the FTC announced a new ban on non-compete clauses, saying that they stifle innovation and suppress worker wages. But before the new rule was set to go into effect, a judge in Texas struck it down, saying the rule was unlawful. The FTC has said it is considering an appeal there. These non-competes have affected workers in Wisconsin across a variety of industries, from the booming health information industry to timber companies to fast food franchises. Alexia Kulwick is an associate professor in the School for Workers at UW-Madison, teaching courses in labor and employment law. She talked to Rob Ferret yesterday.
Can you start us off by fleshing out this concept of non-compete clauses? What are they, and how are they generally working?
Right. Well, so a non-compete clause historically worked in such a way that under an employment contract, for example, an employee in exchange for other consideration, compensation for the work that they're doing, et cetera, agree that on leaving a place of employment, they will not be in competition with the former employer. So a lot of times it would be limited, say, by geography. It would be limited by time period, how long a time frame the covenant's in place. One thing that I just want to say is that covenants not to complete competes rather, historically were used at more the executive level, CEO level. It's in circumstances where people had a full employment contract in which they were receiving generous compensation or benefits in exchange for that. I think what we've seen much more recently prior to passage of the FTC ban is the use of these covenants at more low income levels or any kind of employees that don't have access to anything like trade secrets or customer lists or things like that. So they become a much more common way to, frankly, just harm workers who may want to move on and look for better employment.
Right. The FTC was saying, hey, we're estimating maybe 30 million people in the United States have these non-compete clauses. There are not 30 million high-level CEOs, right? What kind of jobs have we seen these creep into over the years?
Yeah, it's really creeped, right? We have seen it in fast food. We've seen it in construction. We do still see it in medical offices. It's quite common. We've seen it in engineering. So I guess what I would just say is it used to be much more common when folks had access to very confidential information. But today we're seeing it even in manufacturing, even in construction, where somebody may leave a construction company and be banned by one of these covenants not to compete to start their own company. So it has really trickled its way into a more vast array of employment opportunities.
Now, the Federal Trade Commission announced a rule that would have banned non-compete clauses back in the spring. Well, a judge has taken another look at that. But let's look at the rule as it stood, as it was going to be applied. Banned, right? What effect, if it in fact became a rule, what effect would this FTC change have had?
Yeah, so the FTC rule would have eventually completely banned the use of these non-compete clauses, right? And the FTC, just to sort of clarify, is charged with preventing unfair competition. So the FTC took the position that requiring employees to sign these covenants not to compete, in effect, constituted unfair competition in violation of the trade laws, the Federal Trade Commission Act, and therefore it was unlawful. And that's why they used the regulation to propose this ban. The one thing that I will say is there was a gradual implementation built into the rule. So in other words, for those more senior executive level employees that did have employment contracts, for some period of time after the rule was implemented, those could have been enforced. But for all other workers that didn't fall under that category of more, I think they use the terminology senior employees, it would have immediately banned the use of these and any pending agreements would have become void.
What are the arguments that people have had against these non-compete clauses? You've started to allude to some of them, but what do people worry about as the impact?
Yeah, I think there's great impact. I think one is the potential exploitation of workers. And what I mean by that is if they are scared to leave their place of employment because they feel they may not be able to have a similar job somewhere else in the area as a way of bettering themselves, they feel stuck, right? And anytime an employee doesn't feel that they have the mobility necessary, they're much more open to exploitation from their employer. So that's one real concern is worker exploitation. And another is just, I think, the consequence to industry and to businesses as a result as well, in that, you know, it stifles competition, and competition is something that as a policy matter, we in this country had decided is something good for businesses and for commerce and for society to function. So the non-competitive nature, meaning that ultimately you have less and less business entities making all the decisions, is something that from a policy standpoint, many people are very concerned with.
I've seen some businesses seem to maybe back off a little. Let's say, okay, maybe we don't need it for the fast food worker. We've seen legal cases involving that, Jimmy John's in Illinois. But they're saying, hey, we still need this. We've got people, they might have proprietary information that our business depends on. We can't have them running off and working for our competitors tomorrow. Are there tools in the toolkit for what people might see as more reasonable use of non-competes?
Sure, I think so. I think that you can still have agreements and could have, by the way, under what the FTC rule should have been or would have been. If you work for a place of employment, it's perfectly reasonable to say, for example, that you cannot share those trade secrets with anyone else on your departure, right? If you work for an organization and have access to confidential information, such as, say, customer lists or any other kind of more confidential information, you can certainly have agreements that would bar the use of them going forward. The covenant not to compete was just so overly broad and said, you can't now leave this place of employment. Use all of your skills and talent that you've developed and use them somewhere else. So that's really the problem.
We're talking about non-compete clauses for employees in Wisconsin. Alexia Kulwick is with us, associate professor in the UW School of Workers. A district judge struck down a new FTC rule that would have banned these non-compete clauses. Now, Alexia, we're talking about the federal level here. Now, hold on. States have taken action here. Our neighbors in Minnesota, for example, have taken their own action to ban most of these. Other states have done that as well. Do you watch a lot of the action in states to see how these non-compete laws end up playing out?
A bit, right? I mean, I do think we see the federal law tends to be a floor when we're talking about employment law. And then many states do go above and beyond what the federal law bans. So we have seen, as you said, states like Minnesota decide as a matter of state policy, we don't want to allow these bans that bar people from competing, from moving on in employment, and so forth. So it's kind of similar to we see states have higher minimum wages than the federal. States might have better protections for labor organizing, say, in agriculture than we have at the federal level. So certain states have certainly taken steps towards greater protections for workers.
All right. Now, I read the relevant Wisconsin law here. It's a chunky paragraph. I won't read the whole thing, but a couple of key phrases. These are enforceable losses only if the restrictions imposed are reasonably necessary for the protection of the employer or principal. But hold on. Imposing an unreasonable restraint is illegal, void, and unenforceable. Okay. Reasonable. Unreasonable. That's not a lot of definition. I assume this ends up in the courts to decide what constitutes reasonable and unreasonable?
Exactly. And I'll say two things. First and foremost is that a worker is given this covenant not to compete, and they sign it, and they feel they have a contract that prohibits them from doing anything further. Maybe the employer could sue them, but are they going to sue a fast food worker because they started working at another restaurant? I think a lot of times the answer to that is no, but the workers have been convinced that, you know, they really are have their hands tied. So there's that aspect. The other aspect is if you end up in court, yes, this is what happens, is that the courts will look at what they consider to be reasonable. Typically, they're looking at what kind of geographic scope is involved. So if an agreement says, for example, you won't compete with Jimmy John's across the country by working at another individual fast food restaurant, that's going to be considered geographically unreasonable. What kind of time frame are we talking about? Is it just enough time so that you're not taking customers away or you're not directly competing as soon as you leave a place of employment, right? So courts will look at the time frame, and courts will, in fact, even before all of this came up with the FTC, look at what kind of skills and talents we're looking at, right? So a court may say that a covenant is in fact unreasonable under, say, Wisconsin state law or similar state laws, just based on the kind of work that they're doing. My real concern with things like that, again, is employees are given these documents and telling them they're enforceable. And so it's just another form or another method, I think, of exploitation, right? So having it more clear on the books that you can't even do this would be better than an employee having to figure out how they can protect themselves, because it's not a reasonable rule. I think a broader black and white rule may have benefited certain workers a great deal more.
With what's going on at the federal level, the FTC, when they change a rule, they take comments. There were thousands of comments, most in support of banning non-competes. And we gathered a subset of those from Epic Systems in Verona, big employer in South Central Wisconsin. Many Epic employees saying, yeah, we have a non-compete. Not only can we not go over to a competing health information company in this case, we also can't go to clients like healthcare companies. And the list went on to the point where they said, if we leave the company, we basically have to take a year off work. Epic has since said, oh, no, we've dialed back our list of who you can't go to compete with. This particular industry, though, seemed like a really interesting part of the story. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly when you have these, what I might consider overly broad clauses, they're intended to consolidate power, right? And sort of decrease the competition that an entity like that has. So I see it as a somewhere on the continuum of continuing to sort of to consolidate in the industry for profits in a way that doesn't necessarily support workers and certainly may not support their choice of careers. I would question whether the way that Epic previously had its agreements written, I think the court may in fact have found that some of that overbreadth would have been considered unreasonable.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, not in every case would an employer try to enforce their non-compete agreements in court. But from an employee perspective, and you were touching on this earlier, the risk that they might be a pretty big deterrent for maybe you don't want to put this to the test, right? That the worker might feel like, yeah, the odds are not on their side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think particularly some classifications of workers are going to feel that they don't have the ability maybe to go find an attorney to back them up in this matter, that they know that will be an expense. I think in certain industries and certain job classifications, and this may pertain some to the Epic workers, is they do have a level of talent and skill and professionalism that often it will not serve them in a place of potential new employment to know that there's litigation concerning their previous employer, right? There's a huge concern, I think, of employees in filing lawsuits or in being sued by a previous employer that is going to make them look like not a good candidate for potential new employment. So for that reason as well, an employee may decide, I don't know if they're going to sue me or not, but I'm going to honor this because this is my career. These are my talents and skills and knowledge base, and I can't take measures that's going to impede that, my ability to use those skills, right?
So as we've talked about, some states have taken action banning or mostly banning non-compete clauses. Wisconsin, we're writing this one paragraph law and letting the courts sort it out. Haven't been big efforts to revisit this law in Wisconsin. Do you think it would be worth it for state lawmakers to revisit this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. And I think that it would be worth reconsidering this law, right? The language that Wisconsin has now is the same language that many states had previously for many years. And again, the language was created at a time when it was not being used as broadly as today in as many kind of job classifications as today. So now that we do see it in these other industries and different job classifications, I absolutely think it would be worth legislators taking a look at defining when these can be enforced and when not, or just considering the kind of broad prohibition that the FTC was considering.
And getting back to that FTC ban on non-compete clauses, as we mentioned, a judge said, nope, it can't go on. I assume this will work its way up through the court system. What are you watching for? Do you think there's a chance that this rule will end up coming into place?
I certainly think there's a possibility. I think that it absolutely isn't over based on the current injunction that the Texas District Court has issued. So what we have is a Texas court has issued an injunction against the rule, claiming that the agency did not have the authority to implement this rule. We do also have, we had a district court in Pennsylvania had ruled the opposite. So typically we see, right, if you have court decisions that are ruling in opposite ways, typically you're going to see appeals and you're going to see at some point it going up to a higher court. I will say the Pennsylvania case was involving, you know, was specific to the Pennsylvania parties and specific to that area. The Texas court, after the Pennsylvania case, went ahead and issued an injunction across the country. So right now that is where things stand. But I don't see this as over. I see it having a good deal of litigation. I'll say that this seems to be where the courts are in disagreement is, did they have the authority to issue a what they call substantive rule as opposed to just a procedural rule? Pennsylvania court said nothing limited them to simple procedure rules, right? So I think there is still some chance that this could be implemented. I also think that there's some chance it could be heard by the highest court and they agree with the Texas decision. So I think we're going to have an answer through litigation eventually.
Alexia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That is Alexia Kulwick, an associate professor and department co-chair in the School for Workers at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in labor and employment law. We've been checking in on the Federal Trade Commission's attempt to ban non-compete clauses, where the rule stands now, and how non-competes are affecting workers here in Wisconsin. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new documentary captures the highs and lows of the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers.
They went on this incredible run, and it lifted all of our spirits.
It's the director of the film Just a Bit Outside. That's up next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a remembrance of a Milwaukee firefighter who made a difference in this community.
Doran Kemp Jr. was a firefighter with the Milwaukee Fire Department. During his 25-year career, he helped recruit several people of color and women to the field. But earlier this summer, he passed away from cancer. WPR's Evan Casey has a look at the legacy that Kemp left behind.
There are several stories Doran Kemp Sr. loves to tell about his son. He smiles as he talks about their trips across the globe and sitting courtside at Milwaukee Bucks games.
I can't remember a game when his face wasn't up on the big jumbotron doing something. So he was just a very fun-loving, outgoing kid.
Then there was this one time his son wore a Superman costume to entice people to fight fires for a living.
And he would be at the Targets, the Walmarts, and he would see females coming in carrying a couple babies, and he'd say, "Hey, if you can carry two babies, you can carry a fire hose." And then people would always, "You think I could be a firefighter?" He said, "If I can do it, you can do it."
Kemp Jr. became a firefighter in 1999. He followed in his father's footsteps. Kemp Sr. was also a firefighter and captain with the Milwaukee Fire Department for decades. Then, tragically, in July 2024, Kemp Jr. passed away from cancer.
The hardest part for me as his dad was just watching him decline. Because he was such a, just a, I compare him to a 100-watt light bulb. And, you know, near his in, it was like, you know, 40 watt.
Cancer is a leading cause of death for firefighters, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But for the last few years of his life, Kemp Jr. worked tirelessly to recruit residents of Milwaukee to get behind a fire hose. Milwaukee Fire Department Battalion Chief Christopher Brown knew Kemp since they were kids. He says Kemp Jr. even recruited him to be a firefighter.
He had to borderline beg me to try to join the fire department. I'm so glad he did, because it ended up being the best career decision of my life.
As a recruiter, Kemp Jr. was always on the clock. Day and night, he'd take phone calls and talk to others about the benefits of choosing the career.
We could be out and about at night, walking the mall, and he'd see somebody like, hang on, I'm going to talk to this person real quick. And that person might be, you know, extremely short or extremely tall or a little wider or a little skinnier. And you'd see him say, no, I'm not a firefighter. He'd be like, no, we need you.
Brown and other department leaders say Kemp Jr. had a knack for getting people of color and women to become firefighters. Brianna Conway is a living and breathing example of that. She was attending UW-Milwaukee and gearing up for med school, but that all changed after she met Kemp.
I think it was his passion and his love for the job, where it didn't even feel like a job the way he was describing it. It was just something that he loved to do.
Conway says Kemp was there with her through every part of the process, from the interview to the physical training. Now, she's a recruiter herself with the fire department and often goes to high schools across Milwaukee.
But I specifically target young women of color to let you know, like, you're able to do this. Like, this isn't just a boy job.
She's stationed on the city's north side, which is predominantly black. Conway, who is also black, says it's important people see firefighters that look like her and the community.
Going in or responding within our community and them seeing me in my face, and them being shocked or them being encouraged or them like taking a deep breath and being like, okay, I'm fine. Because it's somebody that you can relate to. Even if you don't know me, it's a woman of color that looks similar to you that you can trust.
According to the Milwaukee Fire Department, the number of black and women firefighters have gone up around 7% in the last decade. Many believe Kemp Jr. is one of the reasons for that increase, showing that his legacy lives on.
WPR's Evan Casey brought us that remembrance of Doran Kemp Jr., a Milwaukee firefighter who passed away from cancer this summer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. And now a flashback to the improbable 1982 Milwaukee Brewers season.
After a month-long slump, the Milwaukee Brewers were moving in a different direction. Leading the way was new manager Harvey Keene. And from there, Brewer Cups kept running over and over.
A new documentary showcases what could be the most memorable season in Brewers history. It features new interviews with Hall of Famers Robin Yount, Ted Simmons, and broadcaster Bob Uecker, among others. The film takes us through the highs and lows of the 1982 season, leading up to the franchise's only appearance in the World Series to date. Sean Hanisch is the director and producer of Just a Bit Outside, the story of the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers. Sean, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, hey, Kate, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So the film really focused on this season, this, you know, improbable season that took the team from a losing record to facing the Cardinals in the World Series. Why tell a story of this Brewers team in this year?
Well, it's a team that lives on in, I think, Wisconsin sports lore. It's a team in 1982 that had seven Hall of Famers, five on the field, the owner, Bud Selig, and of course, our amazing broadcaster, Bob Uecker. So all of this talent coalesced during a time when, you know, the city of Milwaukee and the state was in a recession. I mean, things were bleak. And then all of a sudden, this group of crazy characters, you know, amazing characters, great ball players, and just a team that reflected the people who live here. And they went on this incredible run, making it all the way, as you said, you know, to the seventh game of the World Series. And it lifted all of our spirits. And I think the thing that's most poignant in the telling of this story is that despite the fact that, you know, the Brewers and it felt like the whole state lost that seventh game, the next morning, everybody turned out. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people turned out to throw them a parade. Hmm. And can you imagine that? A parade for a team that lost the World Series. So when the town was down, the team lifted them up. And then when the team was down, the town lifted them up. It's a love story.
It seems like it really shows how this was a team of the people. I think I've heard that said there. What does that say about this era in Milwaukee?
I mean, I think it speaks to, it was a different time, Kate. It was a time when players could, they could go out together at night. There were no cell phones.
No social media.
So, you know, there's no gotcha there. It was a time when the players would walk through the parking lot to get to the stadium and then out through the parking lot afterwards and stop to sign autographs, have a bratwurst, you know, chat with the folks and have a beer with them. I mean, can you imagine that happening today?
No. And you were there. You know, you're a 14-year-old kid at the time from Brookfield watching this wild run. What was that like for you personally?
It was, I mean, to be 14 years old and to have a team that takes you on this journey to the World Series was nothing short of miraculous and magical. And, you know, when you're a teenager, you know, there's angst. You know, teenagers aren't known for being like everybody's favorite time of life. So for me personally, you know, it was a beacon of hope, something to get really excited about. It was a place that I spent time with my family and friends at the ball games and felt so much community. So for me personally, this is the most influential team of my life.
I think you've said that the season itself kind of relates to a movie script, that it has these highs and these lows, and at some points you don't know which way it will go.
It maps out like a movie script. I mean, how many cliffhangers did this team have? I mean, first you come out and at spring training of 82, you made the playoffs for the first time. The Brewers made the playoffs in 81. You come out and they stumble out of the gate. I mean, they were in sixth place out of seven teams by the beginning of June. So they fired the manager and they brought on this local legend. He was actually an incredible player in his time. He won a batting title, Harvey Keen. Mm-hmm. He went to high school in Milwaukee. He played baseball for University of Wisconsin, went on to a really great career. And then he was the batting coach. And all the players said, you know, he was kind of like dad. So like when dad was managing the team starting in early June, he loosened everybody up. Hmm. He also inspired them to play, to go out and give it their best. And I mean, as a character in a movie, you can't write anybody better than Harvey Keen. I mean, he had a wooden leg because of his diabetes, and he lived above a bar with his wife, and they ran the bar, and he would be behind the bar serving beers after a game, and the players would go. And as Robin says, you know, Audrey, Harvey's wife, would either cook them a late dinner or an early breakfast.
You do these, you know, in-person and up-close on-camera interviews with the likes of, you know, Robin Yount and Ted Simmons. What did you learn that you didn't know before from doing these interviews?
You know, Kate, the thing I learned was how much that season still lives within them emotionally. The joy that they still take from recounting these stories, the games, the at-bats, the pitches, the camaraderie they had on and off the field. But I think the thing that was the most poignant was the depth of emotion about losing that seventh game and the parade that was thrown the next day. It meant so much to them. First of all, as Robin says, you know, seventh game was the worst day of his life. everything leading up to that was the best year of his life. Typical ball players, you know, they'll give you the pat responses, but these guys really went into the depths of their heart and their soul and laid it all out for us about what their feelings were. And I think that's what's most remarkable about the film. I think, you know, interviewing them when they're, you know, at a place in life where they can remember everything from those seasons, but they're old enough to be like, I don't care what other people think. Like, I might tear up, and that's okay.
Sean Hanisch with us, director and producer of the new film Just a Bit Outside, as we talk about this film documenting the 1982 Brewers team and that season. Can you see draw parallels to what you saw in 1982 versus the Brewers team and today's roster?
It's really uncanny that the film was, you know, coming out this year amidst a team that is. There are two things that really stick out to me, Kate. The first one is the fact that we have a Harvey Keene-like manager in Pat Murphy. He's a guy who I think feels like dad to the players there. It's the kind of guy that he'll put his arm around you. He's the kind of guy that'll tell you, he'll tell you straight. He'll pump you up, get you ready for the game. This team, when they're down this year, they never give up. And that's the spirit of the 82 Brewers as well. They just don't give up when they're out of games. And there is an unparalleled joy that the players feel. And I think that the fans feel this year. I mean, those guys are having a lot of fun. And that's what 82 is about as well. Joy and fun. And, you know, the players are having it on the field and having success. The fans are, we're all right there with them. And, pumping them up and getting pumped up by them.
You also must be pumped up to see this documentary on the big screen in Wisconsin and really where all of this takes place.
We're at Marcus Theaters throughout the state, you know, starting on the 13th, Friday the 13th. I mean, I was an usher at Marcus Theaters. That was my first job.
Oh, okay.
When I was 16 years old, I was the kid in the brown tux. You know, with the bow tie, ripping your tickets and popping your popcorn for you. So to be able to bring this story back to, you know, to Marcus Theaters across the state, it's pretty crazy. We wanted to make this for the fans. We want fans, young and old, the people that have experienced it, we want them to re-experience it. I mean, you know, I have a 12-year-old boy and you know, an 18-year-old daughter, and I want them to experience what we all experienced. So I think it's, you know, this movie's for the fans. And in a way, it's also for the players, too. I think it's kind of a mission to ease their pain, like in Field of Dreams. So, you know, I hope this does that. And I hope that the fans around the state can just relive this remarkable, remarkable season.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Kate. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sean Hanisch is director and producer of Just a Bit Outside, the story of the 1982 Milwaukee Brewers. And the world premiere is tonight at Marcus Majestic Cinema in Waukesha. Recently on the program, we talked about the Wisconsin Master Naturalist Program and its upcoming summit, and we put a call out for you to share about your citizen science projects. We heard from Jill in Mineral Point, who participated in a bat study through the UW a decade ago, and as part of this project, they got tricked out with gear for detecting, identifying, and recording bats. And Jill writes about how this experience got them hooked on monitoring the signals of the local bat population. Let's keep the conversation going. You can drop us a line and share about memorable moments like Jill did in Mineral Point and share about your community. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.